Hi there, I'm Corey.
And I'm Lane. If y'all are looking for a little American magic,
then put away your athames and wands and dig out your box of roots, stones, and bones.
This is New World Witchery.
For our show tonight, we're looking at the world's oldest
magical
professions.
In witchcraft, Lane gives her warped perspective on weaving.
Then Corey shows us who's the fairest of them all with spelled out about iron.
Welcome, welcome. This is episode 30.
Holy crap.
I know, right? So, welcome to New World Witchery, and we're happy to be with you tonight. We'll be talking about magical professions.
Yes.
What brought this on?
Well, there is a whole chapter on it in the encyclopedia.
Yes. The Element Encyclopedia of Witches and Witchcraft, which is from one of our favorite go-to authors, Judica Elish. She has this whole section that's just about magical professions, and she brings up really interesting points. There's this sort of repeated set of motifs in fairy tales and folk tales, where you have specific jobs that are consistently associated with magic or sorcery or witches. So I thought that would be fun to discuss.
Yeah. So we're going to try to figure out why that is.
Mm-hmm. And Lane kind of went along with me on that. So I was like, yeah, that sounds good. I got nothing better to do tonight. So. Cool. Well, let's dive in. Our first one that we're going to discuss is probably one of the better known ones as far as being associated with particularly with witchcraft, and it's midwifery. You're giving me a bit of a look.
I'm just wondering, why is that associated with?
Because there's sort of a strong, I don't want to say historical, because there's a little bit of debate in the academic community about how historical it is, but there's a strong inclination to think that a lot of people who were persecuted during the Inquisition as witches may have just simply been midwives.
Mm-hmm.
People who had certain knowledge of healing and you know, childbirth and things like that, and medical, basically had medical techniques that were not part of an established medical practice, which really the established medical practice came after the Inquisition, but you follow me here.
Right.
And so, because of that, they sort of posed this threat to male patriarchal authority, and...
Isn't that funny that it's still going on today?
Right. That the struggle between the patriarchal authority and midwives is going on. I know, yeah. My wife and I used midwives for all of our... for all of our many, many two children. We used midwives to deliver both of them, and had a great experience.
Yeah.
And it was very, like, it's much more legitimate now. Like, you can actually just have midwives and not have to have a doctor necessarily be a part of the process.
Right, but a lot of insurance companies will fight you on it, and a lot of people look at you like you're crazy, and, you know, like you're hippie crunchy, and...
Right, and heaven help you if you say that you want to do a midwife at home.
Right.
Right.
Or a water birth, for example.
Right.
Yeah, it's just, there's a lot of... kind of irrational, in my opinion, views on midwives, even still today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that, you know, I'm mentioning all this and saying, you know, is it really historical or is it not? Without getting too far into the debate, you know, there were a lot of people persecuted for a lot of reasons during that that Inquisition time. But there definitely does seem to be at least some of that patriarchal authority trying to stamp out an alternative medical practice going on, at least by the 1700s, that seemed to be what was going on. And midwives were really, you know, given a bad stigma by that point. Even if they weren't being actively persecuted, they were being derided. One thing I found, this is from the Encyclopedia of American Folklore. It says, in pre-industrial European society, female healer midwives played a major role in traditional health systems and a virtually exclusive one in childbirth. Both came under ecclesiastical scrutiny as witchcraft based an alliance. They came under ecclesiastical scrutiny as a form of witchcraft based on alliance with the devil. The medieval Catholic Church's witch hunting manual, Malleus Maleficarum, the Hammer of the Witches, devotes question 11, part 1, to quote-unquote witch midwives who, quote-unquote, in various ways kill the child conceived in the womb or procure an abortion or offer newborn children to devils, and proclaims, no one does more harm to the Catholic faith than midwives, who are accused of a range of reproductive system crimes. In the 16th century, the church began licensing midwives as part of its stand against popular belief in magic in an effort to both improve medical practice and to make money. Until the late 1700s, childbirth in America was a social event attended by female midwives, relatives, and friends. By the 1920s, it had become a generally medical event managed solely by male obstetricians. I thought that was really, like, for a paragraph explanation of kind of what has happened to midwives over time, that was pretty concise.
Yeah, definitely.
So, and it's really fascinating if you think about, you know, historically in, even just in America, from the 1600s through the early 20th century, you know, births were pretty much attended by midwives. There wasn't, you know, you didn't have access to doctors like you do right now.
Right.
So midwives were a vital part of the community at that point in time. But now, they're crazy. You know, it's sort of a crazy thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, they, you know, movies perpetuate this, and I think a lot of, like the giving birth horror stories, which not that they aren't out there, but yeah, what am I trying to say? It just kind of perpetuates that it's a medical emergency,
mm-hmm.
and oh, you're having a baby, you have to get to the hospital, when it's like it's a natural thing,
right?
Like, yeah, there's a lot of times when you might need a doctor, but mm-hmm. it's
right, and there definitely is a mortality rate issue.
Oh yeah,
you know, prior to modern medicine, there yeah, I'm not know, trying you to do say, lose people, but
you know, like. I think my views are becoming pretty clear. I don't want to get like into a weird debate or anything. But
No. Well, I think we're both kind of on the same page.
No, I agree, but I just don't want any listener to be like, well, you know, I almost died because my mom almost died in childbirth with my brother.
Right.
And, you know, and I'm very glad the doctors were there, but I'm just saying there are alternative ways, and it's just very interesting from like a witchcraft point of view,
mm-hmm.
you know, why that was like, why we still today kind of see it as.
As scary or foreign or alien.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or backwards. That's a really good way to look at it. Yeah,
that is a good way to look at it.
People tend to look at midwifery as a backwards practice, when in fact it's, you know, not to say it's the world's oldest profession. We sort of made that joke in the intro, but, you know, it might be the world's second oldest.
What came first?
Right. So, you know, it's one of those situations where people have been doing this for thousands of years, and yes, modern medicine has a lot to say to inform, you know, delivery practices and make them healthier and safer. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they need to be the sole providence of an obstetrician.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when, you know, I hate to sound all super crunchy hippie about this, but it's a very female mystery kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, men can't do childbirth. So having a midwife present is really powerful.
I agree.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and another like little thing that I thought of, it's really interesting how many little bits of folklore there are surrounding childbirth.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like how to determine, you know, a baby's gender, or what to do if you're having labor pain, you know, like you mm-hmm. untie the knots, or you put a knife under the bed to cut, the,
cut
pain.
The pain. Yep.
You know, there's just so many little different.
So. Yeah, it's fascinating. There's so much lore built up around it, and you know how much of it is magical folklore and how much of it is practical folklore. But yeah, okay. Well, that's midwifery. Sort of following on the heels of that, this isn't really a profession, but it's something that I saw repeated in a lot of fairy and folk tales. Widows and widowers are there's not strictly a job or a profession, but it does seem to happen a lot in fairy tales that a widow will be the parent of somebody who goes on a magical journey. For example, in Snow White and Rose Red, they're the children of a widow. Jack and the Beanstalk is another good example. It's an old widow.
Hansel and Gretel.
Well, no, she's not. He's a widower. Mm-hmm. He's a widower. Yes.
In some evil versions, stepmom.
Yeah, in some versions, there's not an. It is actually their mother.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I've heard it done both ways.
Yeah, me too. Now that I'm thinking about it.
It's more effective to do it with the evil stepmother
trope,
really
though.
Is,
yeah.
Because it doesn't make the mother sound like a horrible human being who wants to kill her children. But, Not that the stepmother is not a horrible human being who wants to kill children.
Yeah, but I guess it's worse when you want to kill your own.
Yeah. Anyway.
Anyway.
So I just thought that that would be a good one, you know, sort of not lump in with midwives, but it does sort of follow on that same, like, you know, widows would oftentimes be ostracized in their communities because they couldn't necessarily earn an independent living. Or in some communities, they might be the only one who could earn an independent living, you know?
Right.
So it just, there's a good example of that with the wife of Bath in the Canterbury Tales. Like, she's a woman of independent means, and it makes her very, very unique because she's a widow. She's been married, what, like 7 times?
I don't remember.
But, like, she is somebody who actually has land and property because she's been married so many times and a widow so many times. And it gives her a very unique place in that group of travelers. Like, she's the only woman who really gets a strong voice. So, so there's some power to that. That being said, you know, I don't wish widowhood or widowerhood on anybody. I know that it's difficult, so.
Yeah.
So, not to put too fine a point on it, but your mother is a widow now.
Yes.
So that makes you the child of a widow.
Uh-oh.
Mm,
magical, oh, no.
Magical adventures.
Oh, no.
Magical hijinks ensue. So. What's next? We don't have these in order, so we're having to flip our notes pages. So if you hear the rustling of paper, it's not just us trying to sound impressive like we have lots of notes. We actually just have notes that we have to shuffle to find.
But yeah, our next profession is a fisherman.
Yes. Magical, yes?
Yes.
Why magical?
I don't know. I don't have any good theories.
All right. I don't know. A lot of the ones we're going to be discussing, I can peg down, and we'll probably get to this at some point, peg down why they're magical. Fisherman is not one that's as easy for me to peg down. I mean, you do draw life from the sea.
See, which that's is what kind I was, of, you know, or at least you're bringing home food.
And the sea is a really mysterious and scary place.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's sort of like if you could go to caves and, like, throw a line into a cave and pull out food. It's that kind of, like, it's a big womb metaphor, but at the same time, it's also something that could be very dangerous because you don't know what's in there. You know, there's a lot to that. And that being said, most of the fishermen tend to be not victims of circumstance, but they tend to be people who are sort of reacting as opposed to enacting magic on their own. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Like, in a lot of these tales, people make very conscious decisions to do magical things. And in most of the stories about fishermen, they just sort of are trying to overcome an obstacle that's been thrown at them. Some of the stories that I found about this, there's the story in the Arabian Nights about the fisherman who catches the jinn, the genie, and opens the bottle. And the genie comes out and he says, "I'm going to kill you." And the guy's like, "I just set you free. Why are you going to kill me?" And he says, "Well, I've been in there for 300 years. The first 100 years, I said, if anybody let me out, I would make him richer than any man on earth. Nobody let me out. Second 100 years, I said, all right, well, if anybody lets me out of here, I will, you know, give him, I don't remember what the reward is, but something like I'll give him, like, unlimited wives or unlimited prowess in battle or something like that. You know, nobody let me out, so I became angrier still. And by the end of the 300 years, I decided, if anybody lets me out, the first thing I'm going to do is kill him. And the only thing I'm going to allow him to do is pick the manner of his death." And so, the genie, you know, is threatening to kill this poor fisherman. And the fisherman, thinking very quickly, says, "You know, you're awfully big for a genie. And, you know, you said that you're going to kill me. I don't think you have the power to kill me. If you fit in that little bottle, you certainly can't be that powerful." And he said, no, I'm this powerful. Look, ha-ha, look, crushing coconut trees and things like that." And he says, "Oh, well, you're that powerful. Then I don't think you were actually in that bottle, so you really can't be mad at me." He's like, no, I was in that bottle. Look, here, I'll go back in there." And he goes back in there and puts that cork back in. And he's like, "Screw you, dude." Throws him back in the ocean. So there's that. It's this quick-wittedness that's inherent. And I see that in actually several fisherman tales. For example, there's the other one about the fisherman and his wife, who the fisherman pulls the fish out of the ocean. The fish is like, "Oh, great, 3 wishes, don't eat me." And so the fisherman goes back to his wife and says, "Hey, I got these 3 wishes. What do you want, you know, what do you want to do with them?" And she's like, "I want to be rich." And then they get rich. Then She's like, I want to be richer. So she keeps escalating it to the point, and the fisherman keeps going back to the fish and asking for more wishes to cover the problem. And eventually the fish is like, you know, screw this mess. You're going back to the way it was. And that's kind of what the fisherman's been angling for the whole time, is to go back to the way it was.
Angling for.
We're full of the puns tonight.
We're very punny.
I know. And Fisher, you know, fish are definitely associated with, you know, sort of spiritual wisdom in a lot of traditions. There's the fish in Irish mythology, the salmon that eats from the tree of knowledge, the hazelnuts that fall into the stream. It eats them and becomes wise, and if you eat it, you become wise.
Hmm.
And in the Bible, of course, you have Jesus calling the fishermen and saying, you'll become fishers of men, so leading them on this sort of mystical journey. So, fishermen have this thing.
Yeah.
I dig it. But so, fish, magical.
Yes.
Yes. End scene.
I guess that's the end of that. Moving on to more animals.
Mm-hmm.
Shepherds, or animal keepers.
Mm-hmm. I had a harder time coming up with examples for this one, but I did come up with a couple.
Okay.
Shepherds show up in Greek mythology as sort of like, you know, they're helped up by Hermes, who is associated with magic, because he can go between the worlds, mm-hmm. and do things like, you know, he's a psychopomp in some situations. He leads people into the underworld if they need to go down there. And he's associated with shepherds. Also associated with shepherds is Pan,
mm-hmm.
Who's, you know, sort of wild-horned lord of the wood, kind of a motif. Both of those being said, they're not particularly... there are magical associations with both of those deities, but it's not straight out witchcraft the way that you see in a lot of other tales. So I don't know. It's hard for me to include that.
Well, with the sheep, what comes to mind is a later magical job that we'll be talking about, is spinning and weaving, and you know you have to have the wool to do that.
Yeah,
because that was mainly what the fiber they would spin.
Mm-hmm.
So
that makes total sense.
Well, that's what jumps out to me.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't have made that connection. Actually, that's you're the weaver. So, and I did see there were two examples I did come up with. One is in the story of the goose girl. Do you know that story?
I believe so. Yeah, it sounds familiar.
It's this girl. She's supposed to. She's on a journey with her handmaiden, and her handmaiden tricks her out of her sort of role. So she's no longer a princess. She switches places with the handmaiden because the handmaiden has this power over her. And in doing that, the goose girl can never tell anybody about what's happened to her. These horrible things that this handmaiden has done to switch their places. The only person she can tell is her horse. Well, so the handmaiden has her horse killed.
Right.
And has the skull mounted on this pen where the geese are kept. So the goose girl starts keeping the geese and telling the horse about these things every day. And in a nice witchy turn, the horse skull talks back.
Right. Yeah, I do remember that now.
Yeah. So she's not a shepherd. She's a goose tender, but kind of the same idea.
Yeah. Also an animal keeper.
Yeah. And I thought that was very interesting.
Well, and, you know, back to the Bible mythology, you know, mm-hmm. Jesus is also a shepherd.
That's true.
Of you know, men, basically.
Yeah. And finding the lost sheep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, yeah, that's absolutely true. The shepherd mythology there.
Yeah.
The one example I thought of that was a shepherd, this is more modern, but Paulo Coelho's The Alchemist, which I've mentioned on here before, while it does have a lot of sort of New Agey sides to it, the whole story centers around a shepherd who decides to go on this adventure. And a lot of the stuff one of the things that the shepherd points out is, he's learned a lot of things. Like he learns about, you know, how to read the sheep. So like he sees the sheep in the field and they start avoiding this one little part of the pasture. Well, he knows that's probably because there's something dangerous over there now. And so he knows how to look for danger. Just by sort of watching his sheep and watching the weather and watching these things. And he learns to sort of attune to the world around him because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that element too.
Yeah.
But those were the only examples I could really come up with. I like the biblical point there. At some point we will do a special on biblical magic.
Yeah, we're going to have to.
We have to. Okay. Next one's kind of a big one.
Yes.
This is one that I almost hesitate to talk about it because I feel like we're going to get a ton of people that write in about it. Maybe being like, oh, why didn't you talk about this part of it? Or why didn't you mention this part of it? Because it's such a big profession, magically speaking. And that's blacksmiths or metalsmiths. You've got a lot of mythological blacksmiths that are very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
Blacksmiths are... They have sort of this almost dark magical quality to them. They're sort of alchemists on a very basic level in that they transform metal into something else. So there's a lot tied into blacksmith mythology. One great example is the Wayland the Smith, who is in Teutonic mythology, which is in German, some of the northern countries, who he appears in a couple of different epics, basically, including Beowulf. He shows up in Beowulf, and he's reputed to like create some of the most powerful swords that they use to slay dragons or whoever. At one point, I think he's married to a Valkyrie, so that's fun.
Yeah, right?
If you can handle that, you do pretty good. I mean, it's never stated in Lord of the Rings, but they name their swords in Lord of the Rings, like ones like Orc Hammer, and I think they're, this is in The Hobbit, really. But I get the impression that that comes out of this tradition. You give me this look like nerd.
Basically.
He mentioned Tolkien.
We won't go into that.
Yeah. But anyways, but he clearly based a lot of his stuff on Teutonic mythology.
Oh, yeah, definitely. He had a lot of, Norse and
Germanic,
influences. I actually took a class on Tolkien, and
who's the nerd now?
Well, I hated it. If it makes it better,
it doesn't, nerd.
It was required. Okay.
Did you learn about it in your nerd school, nerd?
But anywho, yeah. So I read a lot of his influences, and
So yeah. So that's. I mean, it's definitely something that has had a pervasive sort of thread in mythology. There's some other examples of blacksmiths in mythology.
Hephaestus?
Hephaestus or Vulcan?
Yes.
Is. He's interesting because, and we'll get into this a little bit more later, but he, one of the things he's famous for, he's the blacksmith of the gods, and you know, he's
right.
The only god that's actually lame.
Mm-hmm.
Not like, he's lame, don't hang out with Hephaestus.
He has a club foot, basically.
Yeah, he has a club foot. But
he's married to Aphrodite.
Right. Who cheats on him all the time
with
Ares, because that's just what she does. But so one day to get them, to catch them in the act, he beats gold so finely it becomes invisible and creates a giant net to catch them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting because, one, it's metalsmithing. Two, it's weaving, because he's weaving a net.
Oh.
Three, it's fishing, because he's catching them with a net. So there's a lot in that particular story that I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
Not particularly witchy, but it's interesting mythologically that he combines all of those roles. There's also Ogun, who is in African traditional religions, and is the Orisha Lawa spirit of iron and war. Take that as you will.
Alright.
Anything else? Oh yeah, there's in a book by Nubel Niles Puckett, who wrote a horribly offensively titled book called Folk Beliefs of the Southern Negro.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But he was writing at a time when that was the correct term. So moving on. Moving past that. He writes this book, and he has some interesting observations about sort of southern black culture and its connection with iron. It says, the magic of iron is observed as being most effective against the fairies who shoot stone arrows. And its use is thought possibly to represent a dim memory of ancient strife between the men of stone and iron ages. Others think that the horseshoe charm possibly derived from the crescent of the moon, though natives of North Africa and elsewhere use phallic charms shaped much like the horseshoe to ward off the evil eye. However, one must not too quickly assume an exclusive European origin for horseshoe lore. We've talked about the horseshoe in a previous episode, but he makes a point of talking about these different iron implements and how African Americans were using them for a lot of different things. And so the blacksmith provides all these things. So he's providing all these magical tools to the people. Which I think is very interesting. In the Encyclopedia of American Folklore, something I thought was really interesting, they have a whole entry on blacksmithing. And they break it down by all these different positions. Like, I didn't realize how many different divisions of blacksmithing, of smithy work there were. Let's see. There's the farrier, who does the shoeing for the horses, the wheelwright, who builds wheels, the wainwright, who builds the wagon bodies, the anglesmith, who does iron for buildings, the toolmaker, who makes tools, ornamental iron worker, just all these different divisions, and like a blacksmith would have to be able to do most of those things for each community.
Right.
And you'd have to be able to fit into all these different ways. You think about that. He has a lot of control over his community. I think that's fascinating.
Yeah. Are there stories with, like, can you think of any off the top of your head that feature blacksmiths?
Let's see. I mean, mythologically, there's tons. Like, there's Breed in Ireland, who's the goddess of smithcraft and poetry.
Huh.
Which I think is fun.
Yeah.
So she's poetic, but she's also kind of like, you know, Rosie the Riveter at the same time.
I like that image.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd have to think about it. I know that there were secret societies organized around different professions during the, basically from 1600s on, before that really, but that's when they get really strong, is in the 1600s. And blacksmiths would have their own sort of secret society. But as far as like a folk or a fairy tale, I'd have to really think about that.
Okay. I was just curious.
Yeah. It's nothing's popping into my head, but I know that as soon as we stop recording, I will think of like
course.
Seven different stories.
Well, so what makes them magical? The fact that they're transforming one thing into another, basically?
Yes. And that's something very important to think about. What makes most of these people magical is that they're doing
the transformation.
They have a transformative quality. It's not everybody. Does that. We'll get to a couple that don't, but like the fishermen don't really have a transformative quality in the same way. They fit a slightly different mold, which we'll get to again, in that they can go between worlds.
Yes.
The world of the wild sea and the world of land. They draw things from the deep. It's shamanic, for lack of a better word.
Hmm.
You know, those who take care of the animals, they go between the natural world and the world of humanity. They go from a very isolated world to one where they're connected with people all the time. But yes, yeah, so, okay, and then alchemy. I think that I mentioned alchemy.
Yes, yeah.
So they were the ones who could originally, like, take a base metal and turn it into something amazing. That's a pretty powerful thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get into... There's a little bit of, like... You know how you're saying with midwives... There's all this lore built up around childbirth.
Yes.
There's also a lot of that around blacksmith stuff. But it usually has to do with sort of the leftovers from a blacksmith.
Okay, because I don't think I've heard many or any of these.
We'll get to that mostly in my segment today. But yeah, like all the little sort of remnants that are around the blacksmith shop have magical properties.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Oh, I know... this is not a specific example in terms of, like, I can tell you a fairy tale or a folk tale, but there's a branch of witchcraft, traditional witchcraft, which focuses on Tubal Cain, who was the original blacksmith, biblically speaking. And if you go into Genesis, I'd have to find the passage specifically, but it mentions Tubal Cain, who introduced the art of metalworking. So there's, like, a first blacksmith in the Bible. And it... He sort of descends from this sort of line of fallen angels.
Really?
Mm-hmm. The fallen angels who made it with humanity in Genesis, and created the race of giants. Like, there's a connection between them and Tubal-Cain.
Weird.
Mm-hmm. And then Jubal-Cain, who's his brother, I think, created the first musical instruments. So, that is cool. Musicians, I didn't enter musicians into this category.
Oh.
But I don't know. Like, there are definitely magical associations with musicians.
Yeah. Like, but, you know, the bard and...
Yeah. Well, and they know all the songs, all the magical songs and riddles and rhymes. So, that's one we'll have to think about for, like, Magical Professions Part 2. Okay, so, following sort of on the heels of blacksmiths, with the secret society, something that obviously comes up are masons.
Right.
Freemasons are always associated, I say always, and I'll get an evil letter, are frequently associated with magic and sorcery and, you know, arcane rituals and things like that. So what's your take on that?
I don't know.
Do you think Masons rule the world secretly? You do.
I don't know. I am quite the conspiracy theorist, but I'm not sure about that one.
Yeah.
Because I don't know enough about it. I don't, like, I've even tried to do, like, research on what exactly it is, like, the, you know, the Mason society, and, like, you just don't get any answers.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. Chris Rapello over on The Infinite and Beyond, which is another Pagan podcast, he's a Mason, and he interviewed a Pagan author named Lon Malia Duquette, and they're both Masons, and they were talking about the fact that, like, they constantly get this sort of stigma of being this secret society that's really exclusive and everything. Like, yeah, we're so secret that we have a temple on every main street in every major city in the United States that anyone can walk into at any time, you know, and ask about us. You know, our motto is to be one, ask one.
Hmm.
They're incredibly open. Like, all you have to do is be willing to learn. Like, that's the criteria to join. And, you know, I'm not sure if it's always been that way, but that's definitely how it is now. But what's interesting about that, okay, so we're talking about Masons as the Freemasons as a secret society. Well, but there's a reason they chose the image of a Mason, a stonemason.
Why is that?
Well, I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, I thought you said there is a reason. I know it. Let me tell you it.
Oh, well, I mean, I know sort of from what they say, they're basing it all on this builder of the Temple of Solomon.
Oh.
This master mason and sort of inheriting. That's why they use these Masonic tools like the square and the compass, which would be Mason's tools for drawing a building and putting it together. Which is, again, it's transformation of stone and mud into a building that's habitable by humans. So it's a transformative thing again. But what do you think? I mean, like, what is it about masonry that... This is probably the biggest and best known of all the secret societies, which I guess makes it not terribly secret, but so, like, why masonry? Why is masonry such a powerful magical force?
I do not have any idea.
I don't know either.
I don't know.
Hmm. No. I mean, I imagine, like I said, it's got something to do with that transformative quality.
Yeah.
But I don't know, like, in all the other ones, it's a folksier thing. Like, you transform things on a very personal one-to-one basis.
Mm-hmm.
With masonry, you don't really hire a stonemason to build your house. You might in certain cases, but what they're really designing and what they're talking about in Freemasonry is somebody designing a temple. Like, big building for religious use.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's as though there's something more deeply tied into that particular profession. We really need to have Chris Rapello on to talk about that. That's what we'll do. We'll get him on and we'll quiz him and grill him about Freemasonry, make him spill all the secrets.
All right.
Okay.
Hi, this is Chris Rapello from The Infinite and the Beyond. The Infinite and the Beyond is an esoteric podcast for the introspective pagan mind. Join us as we explore a variety of topics that relate to life and one's unique spiritual journey. Episodes center on paganism, the occult, parapsychology, science, society, and culture in the 21st century. We can be found at www.infinite-beyond.com. From there, you can contact the show directly, visit our forum, and find links for the show and where we can be found online for you to subscribe and download. I hope to be hearing from you soon. Mary Part, Blessed Be, and 93.
Okay, so what's next? Oh, here we go. I'm going to shut up for about 10 minutes, and you're going to talk now.
What I actually can talk on, which is spinners and weavers. Well, now I'm blanking. What? I don't know. Like, ask me a question.
Okay. I was done talking. I don't want to talk anymore. Okay, so spinners and weavers, obviously.
Again, transforming, because you take, you know, the hair from a sheep and...
Mm-hmm.
And twist it up and spin it.
Right.
And then you can, you know, use that thread or yarn to, usually to weave in mm-hmm. mythology. It's not really associated with knitting that much. But yeah, I don't.
Well,
we've
talked about like threads of fate.
Yeah.
That ties into it, of course.
Definitely. One who spins, one who measures, and one who cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of mythology around weaving.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
well, fairy tales-wise, of course you've got...
Oh, yeah.
You've got Sleeping Beauty, who
yes.
is put to sleep because she...
pricks her finger on the...
spindle.
The spindle, which on a great wheel before they had the flyers, which is what basically, like, spins and makes the yarn, it puts the twist into the wool. They weren't actually that sharp. They were just kind of big, and you really wouldn't want to, you know, be too close to it. But it would spin the great wheel, which is one of the, they're also called walking wheels, mm-hmm. and it would put twist into the wool, and then you'd be standing next to it, spin the wheel, and then walk away from it and draw mm-hmm. out your fiber
okay.
and let the twist build up. And then you would walk towards it and wrap it around your spindle, which was the pointy thing.
Oh, so you really did stand a good chance at pricking your finger
yes.
on something like that.
Yeah.
So it was sort of like when she was cursed to that, it was sort of like she's going to do this thing that's pretty normal for her to do.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Rumpelstiltskin.
Yes, Rumpelstiltskin. I love that story.
Which is, it's a spinning story.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of spinning story.
Very different. I liked your take on it, though. Like, we were talking about it earlier.
Yeah.
In that Rumpelstiltskin is kind of a devilish, impish type of...
Yeah, he's a trickster.
Yeah, character.
He knows the game he's playing the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a creepy, he's a creepy character.
I forget, how does she... figure out
his name?
Yeah, I forget.
I can't remember if she goes wandering in the woods or like somebody she's hired goes wandering in the woods and hears him singing and dancing around a fire saying
that's
his name.
That's what it is. Okay, because this is really, really silly. But there was this this old like straight to DVD or straight to video
horror movie.
No, it wasn't horror. It was The Muppets, and it was Muppet Classic Theater is what it was called.
Okay.
And they did a bunch of fairy tales, but they like put a Muppet spin on it. And the way that Miss Piggy figured out Rumpelstiltskin's name, who was Gonzo, of course, was that she saw, like, the inside of his clothes.
Uh-huh.
And, like, Rumpelstiltskin's mom had written his name on his clothes
uh-huh.
to go away to summer camp or something. And so, like, I forgot the actual
right.
method that she finds out. But anyway, that's another, like, way more transformative quality in that he spins...
Mm-hmm.
straw into gold
mm-hmm.
with this magical tool.
Right, that's alchemy 101 right,
right.
there. Base,
but you're not doing the typical, you know, like, blacksmithing type of thing and like, working with the metal. It's just, you
right.
just
it's
spin
magic.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, it's magic.
Yeah.
Straight out magic. And then we'll also
Love
touch
it.
On another part of that story with one of the other entries in these
mm-hmm.
categories, because... there's another magical profession involved with that story as well.
Right.
So, and are there other spinning ones? Oh, there's the Mother Holda,
mm-hmm.
Or Mother Holla, where the girl who goes to visit, basically Old Mother Goose,
mm-hmm.
The way she gets there is she's drop spinning or drop,
spindling,
drop spindling. And she drops the spindle down the well. And has to go retrieve it. Obviously, retrieving a spindle in a well is loaded with magical
right.
imagery right there.
Right.
And, like, she had pricked her finger on the spindle, and so her blood gets in there. So it's just, like, everywhere.
Yeah.
It's just tons of great magical metaphors in that story.
Very interesting. Well, and there's also, you know, some in Greek mythology as well. Ariadne spins a thread, which helps Theseus defeat
the Minotaur.
Yeah. Which was actually her half-brother or something.
Right. son of Minos.
Yeah, so.
The bull of Minos.
And then there's Arachne and Athena and their fight and, you know, where spiders come from, basically.
You'll get into that in your section, I think.
Yes, a bit. Yeah.
And then, I mean, weaving in general, there's Penelope in the Odyssey, who is weaving a tapestry to commemorate Odysseus for as long as he's away, because she has all these suitors waiting to marry her. There's a rich widow with lots of property that I'd really like to get my hands on, so I'll marry her. And she's like, no, not till I finish this tapestry about my dead husband, who I love so much. They're like, okay, we'll wait till you finish your tapestry. How long will that be? Like, oh, a couple more days. It'll be fine. Then every night she's, like, yanking stuff out of her weaving.
Oh.
So that they never know. So she's constantly working on it for years and years and years. Meanwhile, they're, using up her household and, like, eating all their food and all that kind of stuff. So, like, she's living on Cheerios and almonds at that point. But at any rate, so the weaving has a power in that story, too.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I thought of while you were mentioning the transformative quality. Okay, so you're spinning these fibers into cloth. And really with a lot of these different categories, you know, tending animals, keeping animals, you know, basically a type of agriculture, blacksmithing, weaving. There are no other animals that go out and make clothes out of other animals. There's no animals that shoe other animals. And make iron implements. You could argue, yes, some monkeys make tools. Okay, there's a little bit of that. I know that there's some, like, ants that grow mushrooms. Like, they actually farm mushrooms in their burrows.
Ew, really?
Yeah, like, they're literally farming so they can have food to eat. So farming is not completely exclusive to humanity, But by and large, like, a lot of these magical professions are distinctively human professions. They're not things that they're things that set us apart from
gotcha.
From the natural world. So they are already supernatural things.
Well, and a lot of them are, they can be learned, but they also kind of take a little bit of talent, an innate talent.
Yeah.
Like blacksmithing, I don't honestly think. I mean, yeah, I think I could be apprentice and perhaps learn what to do, but I don't know that I could be good at it necessarily.
Right. It would take a lot of effort.
Right.
To learn that.
And I mean, I'm not saying I'm like awesome at spinning or anything, but I mean, I think you're doing 7 different things with your body at one time. I was taught.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's like
kinky.
Well, it's like patting your head and rubbing your stomach, you know, to the nth degree.
Right. While juggling on your elbows. Right. And brushing your teeth.
Right. So you have to learn to balance all these things, and it just, and some people really can't get it or aren't very good at it.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. Like, there are certain of these categories I could never do.
Right.
I've always had an interest in blacksmithing, but I've also promised my wife I will never professionally work in a Ren fair. So, I have a feeling like if I took up blacksmithing, that would be a very short leap.
Right.
So, not to offend everybody who works in the Ren Faire, actually, I love the Ren Faire. I go to the Ren Faire all the time, but it's just one of those things where it's like, she doesn't need me to have another project like that in my life.
Right.
It's like, you have enough crazy projects, please don't start blacksmithing. And I'm fair enough, honey. But yes, there's, I don't know, transformative quality, but all kind of odd and only this innate talent. I think a lot of them are kind of callings.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of patience involved in all of these as well.
Mm-hmm.
Fishermen, I mean, you have to sit and just kind of wait. I mean, you can't really do much to draw a fish.
Boy, that's a great That is a great point. Midwives?
Midwives, definitely.
Baby's going to come when the baby's going to come.
Yeah, spinning. I mean, it honestly, it gets boring for me sometimes. You know, I'm just sitting at the, but at the same time, you, again, with all of these, well, I don't know about blacksmithing, but, because I've never done it, but I would think you would kind of get into a zone with that.
Oh, yeah, rhythmic hammering.
Right, it's all rhythmic. It's all, or like, sitting there and just kind of doing the same motions over and over again, and you really do get into, like, this different meditative state.
Yeah.
And...
Yeah, even with fishing, like, even if you're not looking at it as, like, casting nets repeatedly, the sound of the ocean moving is that repetitive lull.
Yeah.
Boy, and they're all kind of trance-inducing.
Yeah.
Boy, this just opened up live right here, people. You're hearing it as it happens.
There are no notes on this.
Revelation, right here, right now. Yeah, boy, that's crazy. That really opens up my thoughts on this.
I'm glad I thought of it.
Yeah, go you. Way to contribute to the show.
Woohoo!
No, that's really cool.
Yeah, well, let's move on from spinning and weaving. I'll talk a little bit more about that in my segment.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So, the next thing I had down are Millers and Bakers. This goes back to Rumpelstiltskin.
Yes.
Millers themselves, in some of the folklore that you find, they're kind of magical, but what's really magical about them is their kids. Millers' children tend to... embark on magical journeys of some kind. And in Rumpelstiltskin, for example, the miller basically tells everyone that his daughter can spin straw into gold. And so she's obligated to do this. And there's this sort of quality of a deal with the devil where a miller inadvertently makes a promise that someone else has to follow through on. I know. They're such jerks. There's a really gruesome Brothers Grimm story called The Girl Without Hands.
That's a great start.
Yeah, I know, right? right out of the gate, you're already like, well, this isn't going to end well. So in that story, this miller is out in the woods, and he meets him. And this dude just shows up in the woods and says, why are you toiling and laboring? I'll make you rich beyond belief, and all you have to do is promise me whatever's behind your house right now. And he's thinking, well, I've got an apple tree behind my house. You can have my apple tree, sure. And he gets home and he finds out, oh, my kid was behind the house, my daughter. And so...
That pesky daughter.
I know. And so the devil comes to claim her. Well, the devil can't have anything that's been freshly washed in water, of course, because water has magical properties. So he orders the miller not to let her bathe. Well, when she finds out that she's going to be taken by the devil, she just weeps and weeps and weeps into her hands, and her hands get covered with tears. And so the devil's like, well, I can't take her because her hands are all wet. So he's like, you know, get one more day. But she does it again. So he says, okay, you got to cut her hands off. You can't have this crap. So the miller has to cut her hands off. And then the devil can, and then she cries into her stumps, basically, at that point. The devil's like, I'm done with this. You can keep her, like, after the hands are cut off.
Oh, my God.
And so then she goes out wandering in the world because she's been horribly deformed, experiencing this bit, what's called a shamanic injury. Which is, in a lot of stories, somebody will experience an injury, the prick of the spindle. Or they'll lose a hand or lose an eye. It's all part of the shamanic journey. And so she goes out and she winds up marrying a king who makes silver hands for her to use instead of her real hands. And that's tied into some folklore mythology. Like there's an Irish story about a king named Nuada of the Silver Hand, who has a hand made out of silver. And he's injured in battle, loses his hand in battle, and he can't be king anymore because in Irish tradition, you have to be a whole person to be a ruler.
What?
Not currently. Well, they don't have a king, obviously.
Well, right, but...
But in that time frame that you had to be a whole person, a completely integrated person to be a king, you couldn't have a blemish like that.
Wow.
So when he lost his hand in battle, they're like, yeah, he can't be our king anymore. So he goes off and he gets a silver hand made for him. He's like, yo, got a hand again. They're like, hey, cool, we can be our king again. So there's that tie-in. But anyway, baker's children tend to show up. And bakers, again, are another transformative profession. They take whole grains and turn them into something you can use to make food.
Again, with the patience.
Yeah, it's a very, yeah, because you have to just wait for that the grindstone to take it down to powder.
Mm-hmm. And then wait for the dough to rise and wait for it to make, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Something that was interesting is a lot of these are very old world. A lot of these things we've been discussing are old world professions.
Yes.
Blacksmiths do show up in the new world. Weavers, obviously, you can't remember without weavers, midwives we've talked about. But bakers are some of the very few examples I found that are in New World lore that are often in folklore that has magic in it, that specifically applies to them. Like, a lot of the Jack Tales from Appalachia don't have a lot of magic in them. They're sort of devoid of that magic. But bakers, there's a couple stories up from New York called Baker's Dozen, which tells the origin of why 13 is a baker's dozen.
Oh.
And then something called The Gift from St. Nicholas, which is about these cookies that a baker makes on Christmas Eve, and St. Nicholas comes and you know, approves of them, basically. And these very specific magical things happen in their stories.
Hmm.
So it's one of the few professions I found where, like, there's distinct evidence of New World magic. So, and then, of course, how could I forget? In one of my son's favorite stories, there's a baker who creates a magical being called the Gingerbread Man.
Ah!
Who just runs as fast as he can. You can't catch him. He's the Gingerbread Man. And that, I know it's going to seem silly to talk about that as a magical story, but I mean, man makes a walking, talking cookie. That's pretty magical. And two, there's this weird, like, completely whimsical version of the Golem story or the Frankenstein story going on in that. Like, he imbued something created with life. He played God for a minute. And in doing that, created this thing that's out of control.
Was it because he wanted a son?
It might have been.
Or am I confusing it with Pinocchio?
The version I do with my son has all of 50 words in it, so so it doesn't get into motivations all that much.
Okay, gotcha.
But in Pinocchio, he definitely wanted a son.
Yeah, I remember that, but I don't remember if it was the same thing.
I think in the Gingerbread Man, there may be something about that, too. Like, they didn't have a child, so, like, he was going to make a gingerbread child, and it runs as fast as it can. Yeah, so there's that. Speaking of the Golem, let's sort of use that as a segue into the next category, which is the scholar / professor.
Ooh, okay.
And in that, I'm also including something like a rabbi would be in that too. And the reason I mentioned the Golem, if you don't know what the Golem is, in, I believe, 15th century Prague. I'd have to go back and look, but in medieval Prague, a rabbi named Rabbi Lo, or Rabbi Loa, created this clay giant person, like 7-8 foot tall clay person. I'll have to get a picture of it and put it up on the website.
Okay.
Because we found in Prague, they had this place where you can take a picture of the Golem of Prague. It's a real thing.
Wow.
It's real in terms of, like, they believe it was real, and so they have these things that I think are recreations of it. I didn't speak Czech well enough to really inquire about that, but anyway. So he creates this sort of giant clay monster and imbues it with life using the sacred name of God. And he's using it so that he can, you know, help the people in the ghetto, the Jewish people in the ghetto. You know, he runs errands for them and does all these things, but he gets out of control.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like a gremlins thing, like don't feed them after midnight.
Right.
And he feeds it after midnight or something to that effect, and it goes crazy.
There's actually a X-Files episode about a golem.
Oh, there you go.
And it's one of my absolute favorites, actually.
There you go. I have to track that one down. They've got all the X-Files on Netflix now.
You should watch it. It's hilarious.
I will have to. Yeah, so there's that. And that sort of is the central takeaway for that category is usually when you're looking at the professor or scholar, it's someone who pursues magical knowledge or magical means and can't control it. Does it go too far?
Mickey,
the Sorcerer's Apprentice. There you go. That's a good example.
I just see brooms carrying buckets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my wife just asked me a little while ago, like, why can't I do that to make the house get clean? Like, don't you remember how badly that ended for Mickey? There are a lot of examples of the scholar professor thing. There's Faust, mm-hmm. Dr. Faust. There's a sort of follow-up tale to Faust that I found while I was in Prague, which is called The Student of Prague, where a guy moves into Faust's house.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like a young student moves in there and starts, and he keeps finding like gold coins on top of this burned circle in the house. And so he starts like doing all these things. And then finally one day people hear an explosion and they go in and there's a burned circle on the floor where he's been finding the money. But now there's a burned circle on the ceiling right above it. And he's nowhere to be found. It's like, oh, well, that didn't work out too well for him. And then, let's see. Like, just that whole medieval scholar model. You know, they're pursuing magical knowledge that they probably shouldn't be pursuing.
That kind of reminds me of a Poe story.
Which one?
I forget the name of it. I believe it's one that's named... the name is a woman's name.
Okay.
But the name of the story is a woman's name. But he... He's telling the story of his lover who has died, and he's like, he's telling of like, subtly of different things he's doing,
mm-hmm.
and he's basically doing this occult ritual to bring her back to life. And he's at the end of the story, he's terrified because it worked.
Right, basically. Like there's a knock at the door.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. That's pretty scary.
Mm-hmm. I remember reading that going, oh, this is awesome, like, on one level because I love Poe, but uh-huh. then on another, I'm like, that it's...
It's occult.
Yeah, and it's magical, and it's American, which
yeah.
I love.
Yeah, of course. That's very true.
Yeah.
Boy, Poe. I love him. Poe and Lovecraft, they both have their, like, they have their occult and, like, weird.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it. Not a counterpoint. I'll get to the counterpoint in a second. Another example of this in a more modern setting, there's a novel and a movie called Burn, Witch, Burn, which I actually just watched recently. You can get it on Netflix streaming. It's an older movie, and it's about this... It's actually hoodoo. There's hoodoo in it.
Oh, really?
Which is this ethnography folklore professor, basically anthropology professor, and his wife moves to this new university. And he talks a lot about like these folk magical religions as though they're all like... Pshaw,
mm-hmm.
but he examines them as primitive society. Well, then he finds out that his wife has been like doing little spells all around the house to protect them because every other woman on campus is a witch. Like all the other wives are witches. And so like he makes her get rid of all these things that have been protecting them and things start going really badly for them.
Oh.
It's a pretty neat movie. And it's a lot of fun. There's a lot. It is hoodoo. Like it's very straight up. Like the things that they use are hoodoo magical spells.
I've never heard of this movie.
It's pretty good. It's enjoyed. It's just, you know, early 60s, black and white.
Hmm.
So it's fun. But that was something I thought of. The counterpoint to the scholar professor thing as, you know, fooling around where they shouldn't be fooling. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. In that book, the man who takes in the Pevensey children is named Professor Diggory Kirk. He's a professor. He owns the wardrobe, the magical wardrobe. And when they come back the first time from Narnia, he's like, oh, very interesting. And believes them completely.
Hmm.
As though he knew something more about it.
Right.
And later on in the books, you find out that he actually does know quite a bit about it. Because he was there at the creation of Narnia.
Oh.
With Aslan.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've only read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I haven't read the full series, unfortunately. I own them. I've been meaning to. It's just happened.
But. They're fun. I mean, you know, people beat the Christian allegory out of them because people want Christian allegory out of them, but they are a fun and interesting
choice. I loved book. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I reread it so many times growing up.
Yeah. It's a great book.
Yeah.
I think The Magician's Nephew is the one where you find out about him. It's like The Magician's Nephew or The Silver Chair. Anyway, one of them you find out that he knows more about what's going on. But so yes, there are some where the professor is sort of the more of like a trickster figure who knows what's going on but doesn't let on.
Right.
So it's interesting you have that dichotomy.
Can you think of anything else where that happens?
I'd have to really apply my knowledge there. There's a novel by a guy named Gustav Meyrink who wrote in Eastern Europe during the first half of the 20th century called The Green Face, and it's about this wandering Jew, this archetype of the wandering Jew, and this little cult society that forms, and one of them, I believe, is a professor. Actually, a couple of them are professors. And they some of them get into the, like, you went too far category, but one of them, I think, is the one who's like, no, this is what you need to do, and sort of orchestrates the whole thing.
Hmm.
I feel like there's a better example, though.
I know, like, we're missing it, but who knows? If anybody thinks of it, they can email us.
Got a terribly obvious one.
What?
Giles.
Duh. Oh, my God.
He's the librarian, which I guess you could throw a librarian into another category.
Well, he was definitely a scholar.
But yeah, there's that scholarship who knows and is there to help. He's there to facilitate. But it's interesting, in those roles, there's support role to usually a main. I really identify with that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's kind of what I want to be, is mm-hmm. that scholar professor who knows all this occult stuff and can help you out in a jam. But, like, I'm sort of the sidekick or the one that, like, will help you figure out the problem. But I'm not fighting that dragon. You enjoy that? Here's your pixie dust. And, oh, okay, so for our last major category, this is one that was really fun. Like, I had never thought of this until I read this in the Judica Elish book, but it's spot on as far as a magical profession. And that is a coachman or ferryman.
Yes.
What a killer subcategory.
Yeah.
So, can you explain a little bit about what those are?
To me, they go along in the same category kind of with fishermen, and that they go between,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're always, like, in most stories, you know, they usually don't even have names, they're just the coachman,
mm-hmm.
and, yeah, they just, they take you to where you need to be, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one example I can think of where they do have a name is Charon, the ferryman of the dead in Greek mythology,
okay.
where you pay him the 2 pennies from your eyes to cross the river Styx.
Right.
But yeah, like, usually these are, you know, mysterious, sort of unearthly coachmen that take you between the places you need to be. I did a story, the Devil's Marriage, as one of our podcast specials a while back,
mm-hmm.
and in that part of it occurs in a coach, an enchanted coach, that, I don't remember, it's driven by ravens, but there's sort of like a... You know, that kind of like, oh, it's clearly an unearthly thing going on. So the coachman there is magically inclined. There's something called the death coach in New York folklore, which is like a coach that arrives to take you between the worlds.
That's in Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
Well, there you go.
Randomly. I don't think they call it necessarily like the death coach, but like it's a... horse-drawn mm-hmm. carriage that comes to
mm-hmm. to take you away.
Take you off. Yeah.
Mm. You know, there's a movie that I rave about and love called Spirited Away, where this isn't a coach, but it's kind of the steampunk equivalent thereof, which is a locomotive.
Yeah.
And when she's in the land of the spirits, like, to get between the bathhouse where all the spirits are, the main action of the story is, and this sort of swamp where the witch that she needs to visit lives, she has to get on this train that's basically the train of the dead, and like ride the train of the dead out to the distant reaches of the spirit world. It's the same kind of coachman, that journey.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that idea of like sort of being that psychopomp, very between the worlds. Pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. Well, another one I keep thinking of, I know it's Disney, but like Cinderella, you know, like I don't know if that's actually in the Grimm's story, but...
Right, but the coach seems to be essential, right?
Right. And the coachman is very... I mean, she turns mice, and so mm-hmm. she get, you know, into humans so she can have a coachman.
Mm-hmm. I think that might actually be in in some of the original. There's a version of the Russian version of it called Vasilisa of Cinderella, where you encounter the witch Baba Yaga in that story. And I think even in that one, maybe it's a wooden doll instead of mice. But yeah, they're sort of like they serve the coachman function. Oh, speaking of the Vasilisa, I missed this during the Spinners and Weavers section of it, but she spins flax. She's required to spin flax in that one.
Well, see, now there's another material that you could use.
Mm-hmm. Well, plant. I mean, there's this whole, like, plant lore. Like, you have to know which plants you can use to spin fiber.
Mm-hmm.
So there's plant knowledge involved there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what are some other, like, one-offs, the things that I came up with, like, a list of a few that are not, there's not as broad support for them, I think, in folklore.
Right.
But I couldn't say that they're not magical professions, and I really wanted to talk about them just briefly.
Cobblers.
Mm-hmm. Of course, elves and the shoemaker.
Mm-hmm.
I think I put another one. Oh, the Red Shoes. Hans Christian Andersen's book, or story of the Red Shoes, involves shoemaking. Hunters. Hunters are occasionally turn out to be magical
mm-hmm.
or encounter magical things. What else?
Soldiers.
Yes. Yeah, a lot of the Jack tales are about a soldier coming home from war when he encounters X, Y, or Z. Sometimes they're about, like, the foolish Jack setting out from home.
Right.
But if they're not that, then they're usually Jack coming home from war.
Hmm.
And if that's the case, there's a really fun story about Jack the soldier who goes to spend the night in, like, a haunted castle. And all these demons come around to try and defeat him. And he challenges them to a game of cards and wins. And so he gets the castle and gets the best of the demons. So there's definitely some magic in that. And then 12 Dancing Princesses. It's a soldier who figures out the secret of the 12 Dancing Princesses in that story. Do you know that story?
No, I don't.
There are these 12 princesses who get new slippers every night. And every morning when they wake up, their shoes are worn out. And so the king wants to find out what's going on. But nobody can give him an answer. And so there's a challenge issue that if you can figure it out, you get to marry whichever of the princesses you choose. But if you can't figure it out and you take more than 3 nights, then you get put to death.
Oh, fun.
Mm-hmm. And so a soldier decides he's going to do it, and he figures out that they've been drugging the people who have come before him. So he doesn't drink their wine. And then he follows them into this other world and finds that they're dancing all night long with these 12 sort of princes of the underworld.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you could sort of argue that soldiers are kind of between the worlds.
Mm-hmm. Well, between life and death, for sure. Yeah,
exactly. Like, you never know what's going to happen in a war.
Yeah, you don't get that close to death without, you know, walking away with some serious otherworldly ideas.
Right.
Yeah, so those are the magical professions I came up with. Can you think of any others that we've missed?
I'm sure I will, but at the moment, no.
Okay. I know we mentioned librarian, but that falls under that scholar heading, I think. If you have any suggestions out there, listeners, I know, you know, we covered 9 and a few extras. I know we missed some. So if you have any suggestions, I'd love to hear them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's take a break. Because we've been talking for a long time. I might actually possibly insert a random break somewhere in this episode so people aren't listening to us yammer. And when we come back, you're going to tell us all about weaving?
Yes.
Excellent.
My name is Scarlett. I'm an eclectic neo-pagan witch based in Wisconsin on the shores of Lake Michigan. On my podcast, Lakefront Pagan Voice, I share my perspective on pagan topics, life, local flavor, and a few of my favorite things. I'm always learning, and I hope you'll explore with me. You can find my show on iTunes and at Podbean. And here is a cow.
Hi, Hi, I'm Saturn, host of the podcast Pennies in the Well, where we journey into the depths of the human psyche and the far realms of magic for the joys of spiritual development. You can find me by doing a search on iTunes or Podcast Alley, or visit my website at www.penniesinthewell.com, because there's nothing quite like slipping into the well.
Trouble figuring out how to start this segment. Pshaw, I say.
So weaving. This is basically like one of the last yarny crafts I had yet to do, but I finally got a chance. A friend of mine has a loom, so I got to try that out and made a scarf and everything. So that was pretty cool. So I wanted to talk about it since it's steeped in magical mythology and folklore and all this other fun stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the main one that jumps out for me is Arachne and Athena.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know the story, I'll give you a basic rundown. Arachne was a really awesome weaver, and she basically starts boasting that, you know, she didn't learn her craft from anyone, you know, and doesn't want to be considered a pupil of anyone, even Athena, who is also an awesome weaver and, you know,
mm-hmm.
a goddess of crafts, you know, spinning, weaving.
Right.
Yeah. So, Athena hears of this. She is not happy. So she comes down disguised as an old woman and kind of says, you know, you know, say you're better than everybody else, whatever, I don't care, but you probably shouldn't challenge Athena. And Arachne, again, just...
She's all like, whatever. Athena can suck it.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Whatever, I'm totally better than Athena. So then she transforms into herself, and they have a competition.
Let the smiting commence.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. So Arachne weaves this beautiful, huge tapestry, basically. And it's the scenes are kind of depicting...
like all the follies of the gods,
yeah,
folly, right?
That's a good, yeah, follies of the gods.
Yeah.
And so it enrages Athena, and she kind of just rips everything up, and what does she do? She strikes her, and it kind of like this image. It just made me think of like a revival where, you know, the preacher will come up and touch your head and like. And you just zap
yeah.
down or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, like, she kind of, like, zaps, like, all the guilt and shame that she should be feeling into her. And so Arachne, out of this guilt and shame that she feels, she goes and she hangs herself. And so Athena, feeling, I don't know what
sort
at this point.
Sort of remorse.
Yeah. Sort of, like, I don't know. It's a weird...
Not really remorse so much as relax.
Yeah. I like that.
That's terrible.
That was a good one. She, so she brings her back to life, but she transforms her into this spider. So she'll basically always be hanging from this thread.
But she'll also always be weaving. So
right, and weaving these beautiful things.
And then she lets her open an Etsy shop or something.
Right? Oh goodness! But and then another one I mentioned was Ariadne, and her spinning. And I just wanted to bring up. I think it's funny that like in. You said Dreamweaver,
mm-hmm.
and it's Ariadne was one of the main characters in Inception, which is what she does.
Oh, yeah.
She weaves
that's right.
dreams.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So, anyway, I just thought that was cool.
See, I'm always thinking ahead.
You are.
It was not just a random thing.
You're helping me out.
Exactly. My golden pipes, they're at your service.
That's right. So, I wanted to give like a little practical bit on weaving and what you do, basically, for those who don't know or have never even been around a loom. So the main contraption that you weave on is called a loom, and you start out by what is called warping it. So the vertical the yarn that runs.
Well, what are the parts of the loom? You've got the actual frame.
Yes.
Right? And then you've got a shuttle, right?
Mm-hmm. That's the thing that passes back and forth between the threads.
Right. So what you do is you have, like, these vertical threads,
mm-hmm.
and then you've got the shuttle flying back and forth making horizontal threads, right?
Right. Thank you. That's a good way to describe that. Yes. Okay. And so, but you have to tie these vertical threads on, and that is called the warp.
Okay.
And, you know, you have to get it even and everything, and it's mm-hmm. actually quite a process to do. That's the slowest part of weaving, is warping your loom. So then you take, you know, the horizontal threads that you make is called the weft, and that is usually loaded onto your shuttle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, just wrapped around a few times, and you just start going back and forth. And the reed is what you pass the yarn through, and it has a series of, well, in modern ones, I'm honestly not sure about older ones, but the one I worked on had holes. And then lines, basically, like open slots. There we go,
okay.
Slots. So you put one strand of your warp through a slot, and then the next through the hole, and the next through a slot. So you alternate.
Okay.
So
you wind up with, like, two lines of thread.
Right.
Sort of.
But when it's in
on
a,
top of each other.
No, they're right next to each other.
Okay, yeah.
And they just... But that's in when it's in, like, a resting position, when your reed is. But then there's upshed and downshed is what it's called. And when you go upshed, you bring your reed up, and there are little slots on your loom that you sit your reed into.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings the yarn in the holes up above the ones in the slots. And then that... little triangle that's formed by the two threads being lifted apart is called your shed.
Okay.
So you pass the shuttle through the shed, and so that puts it through the shed, and which does the weaving, basically. Like, do you see how it...
Right, it shoots it through this tube once, then you change it.
Yeah, then you put it in the down shed,
yeah.
And then the yarn that was on top is now on bottom, which... makes it go, you know, on top every other piece of yarn in your warp. And then when you bring it down shed, it's going to go under every other piece of yarn in your warp. So I hope I'm describing it. And you can find videos on YouTube,
we'll definitely link
one so you can see what I'm talking about when I'm talking about it. But anyway, and it's really fast. It's really relaxing. Like I said earlier, it's... You do get into sort of like a mental
health
state. Yeah.
Trance.
Yeah.
While you're doing it.
And it's so fast. It's so much faster than knitting.
Like, other than setting up the warp.
Other than warping your loom. It's that took forever for me. But
I'm sure you get faster if you do it a couple times.
Yeah, definitely. But you have to have a lot of space, usually. Mm-hmm. But anywho, the magical implementation of this would basically be the same that I've talked about with knitting and spinning, in that, you know, you could use color, or you could put certain things onto your weft yarn and, you know, and actually weave them into the fabric. And it'd be so much easier to just kind of stick something in there.
Mm-hmm. And then something that we had sort of talked about when you were bringing this up as a segment, because you get into this rhythmic pattern, it more so, I think, than you do with knitting or maybe even, well, spinning, you could probably do this too, but I think you could probably come up with like a rhythmic chant or a rhyme.
Yes.
Like, you could really incorporate verbal spoken magic that, you know, you're speaking a spell at the same time you're doing this rhythmic activity. So it's like every thread gets imbued with a spell.
Right.
As
like
you're doing
what
it.
I picture doing is, making, let's say, an altar cloth, or maybe a shawl of some sort to wrap around you, or maybe even
like
just
a shawl.
Yeah, or maybe even just like a thin piece of fabric for like a belt or a sash or something that you might use in ritual. But so you could do this in a magical setting because it's so fast, You know, if you warped it beforehand, and then you could just sit there and chant and have your magical piece of cloth, you know, done like that pretty much. And it would have all this magic imbued into it, and then you could use it in your magical...
Right. Yeah, it's good to sort of fabricating a spell or an altered cloth, or a tool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I really like that the idea of doing an altar cloth and like and doing it within a magical space, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just like and have it be something where like every second of your involvement with that has been magically charged.
Right. Yeah.
No, I think
you could even bless your limb if you wanted to.
Yeah, a little blood on it. little lamb's blood. yeah, cool.
So yeah, hopefully that was clear.
I think so. I think with the videos, it'll be clear enough that like between what you said and between seeing the videos, people will get an idea of what you're talking about.
I hope
about.
So. If you need any more clarification, please let me know. But yeah, let's move on to spelled out.
All right. You have any clever songs for my segment?
No, I'm sorry.
Pshaw, I say. Okay, so. What I'm going to be talking about tonight, in general, is going to be iron, and in specific, is going to be war water. But let's start with the iron. Iron, as we discussed in blacksmithing, has this long-standing association with magic. There are a lot of people who say that, you know, iron will repel magical creatures like demons, fairies, anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you keep iron around, it fights off evil forces. I found, you know, a lot of fun folklore having to do with different iron implements and different iron items. From Vance Randolph's Ozark Folk Magic, it says, nails taken from a gallows are supposed to protect a man against venereal disease and death by violence. Country blacksmiths used to secure the nails and hammer them out into finger rings. So, I don't know if you've ever seen, like, at a Cracker Barrel, you'll see these like old railroad tie nails that are bent into ring shapes, and those are to keep your coochie clean.
Oh,
fight off the venereal disease and death by violence, which is also a nice thing to fight off.
Yes. But,
Randolph also says a little iron wire worn as a necklace, according to some power doctors, will protect a child from whooping cough. That's not sound medical advice, and I'm not dispensing it as such, but merely providing this folklore. And then we'll get to the last tip I found of him in a minute. Looking for sort of more ancient sources on this, there's a book by E.E. Burris, which is all about Roman religion, called Taboo Magic Spirits, in which he says, the taboo on iron dates from the beginning of the Iron Age, when religious conservatism forbade the use of the strange new material in place of the usual bronze. It has been suggested that the magic significance of iron arose from its susceptibility to magnetism, which, as the superstitious Romans often believed, derived from witchcraft. Mm. So, it's long had this witchy association. It's interesting, in Roman religion it kind of had an inverted association, because it was seen as a witchcraft tool. Alright, so, and in Henry Hyatt's Folklore of Adams County, he talks about you would take a piece of old iron and hang it over the front and back door to prevent the spirit from the recent dead from haunting you.
Which is still used today. People still use iron to, ghost busting, basically.
Yeah, basically. He also says 5 iron nails driven into the trunk of a tree prevent fruit from falling off. Anyway. So those are some of the various iron folklore that I found, just having to do with, you know, hanging a piece of iron in your house or carrying iron with you. But remember how I talked about, like, blacksmith leavings being really important? Okay,
yeah.
That's where I'm going to get into now. In that Nubal Niles Puckett book, Folk Beliefs of the Southern Negro, he says, anvil dust is also greatly valued as conjure material. One educated blacksmith of Columbus, Mississippi, tells me that people are constantly coming to his shop to get the black flakes that fall from the hot iron when it's pounded, although they always look ashamed and give fictitious reasons as to why they want it. Anvil dust is basically iron filings.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use that to feed lodestone, or you can use it to make various concoctions that involve iron. Vince Randolph says, the water in which a blacksmith cools his irons is supposed to be good for witched cattle and is sometimes given to human beings also, particularly children. H.M. Hyatt from Folklore of Adams County says, water from the tub in which a blacksmith cools hot iron is a good wash for the sore udders of a cow. A broken-winded horse, or horse with the heaves, becomes well if given water in which a blacksmith cools hot iron. Your looks will be improved if you wash your face frequently with water in which a blacksmith has cooled hot iron. Slack water, the water in which a blacksmith cools hot iron, is also a good wash for poison ivy.
Hmm.
Those are from multiple different sections of that same book. There is this repeated and constant thing I kept finding about if you take water that a blacksmith has cooled his tools in or cooled a piece of iron in, that water has magical properties.
Very interesting.
Very, very interesting. It's got beauty properties, anti-witchcraft properties, pain
healing.
Relief properties. Yes. All these different things. So I was originally thinking that would be sort of what I focused on with the segment. But then I had to be realistic and say, you know what? Not everybody has access to a blacksmith. So taking sort of a slight run on that, if you can't find a blacksmith and convince him to let you have his leftover water, which if you can, please do, because that's an awesome magical tool right at your disposal. It sounds like it's pretty multi-purpose. You can make something called war water. Now, in war water, there are a few different recipes for it. Zora Neale Hurston records one that says it's oil of tar and water that has been filtered. Basically, that means that you're mixing turpentine and water, which is not healthy in any way, but it's whatever. Turpentine is sort of a residue of pine, so it's not particularly iron-related. However, a lot of other sources I found talk about war water actually being, for example, from Lucky Mojo's website, war water is basically suspension of iron, rust, and water, with other ingredients added according to the desires of the manufacturer. She talks about how, because it's associated with the Roman god Mars, it's probably not particularly of African origin. It looks like it came in through European sources. But because there are iron deities in African traditional magic, it may also be a connection there. She says additional ingredients included in more water to make it stronger are magnetic sand, that anvil dust that we were talking about, rusty nails, coffin nails, Spanish moss, an evil-looking twisty gray herb, which rots away in the water quite nicely, provides proper blackness to the red ochre color of the basic mix, and imparts an appropriate swamp water scent when you break the bottle open. And then Dry Mikharitz has a recipe in his Century of Spells, which is basically the same thing. You just take iron. You can take like a railroad spike, an old railroad spike. You can take iron nails, whatever you've got. Make sure that they're cut enough so that they will rust. Like, you don't want anything that's been polished. Mm-hmm. You want something that's got raw surfaces of iron. Put it in water. Let it breathe. You might want to put like a piece of cheesecloth over it so critters don't get into it. And let that thing start rusting, you know, shaking it around a little bit so that it can move the rust around. And once it gets a nice kind of rich red color, it's ready to be war water.
Hmm.
And if you want to, you can then add things like the Spanish moss to it. And the way you use war water is basically it's a substitute for hot foot powder. If you want to get rid of somebody, you sprinkle it around their home. Or, more traditionally, you take a bottle of it and you throw it on the doorstep and it breaks and shatters all over their doorstep.
That's appropriate.
Yeah. They're going to get the picture.
Yeah.
In that situation. So that's how you would use it, is basically as a hot foot. It convinces them to move away. You can also use it to perform slightly more potent curses. There's also a good indication that when it was originally made, it was made because you would take just that iron rust water and drink it as a cure for anemia.
Oh.
Not recommend. Again, this is not a medical thing. Don't do it. Not medical. Bad. But, you know, it's an interesting thing that kind of came out of that. So it was originally used as a healing agent.
Yeah.
And became a powerful repellent. It doesn't seem to have the same really, like, wicked curse properties that something like Goofer Dust does. It's definitely more of a, you know, move you away, get out of my space, I don't want you around thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's perfectly reasonable to have it on hand. You know, help you get rid of people that you don't want around. I'm actually thinking about using it on somebody fairly soon. But that being said, if you want to give it a try, please let us know how it works for you.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, that's my segment.
Awesome.
Do we have announcements? I know. Oh.
Yes,
we'll get to the super awesome announcement in just a second.
Okay.
But I do want to take a second. Okay. Night we're recording this, poor Joplin, Missouri has been absolutely hammered by a tornado and is, you know, parts of it are in rubble and ruins. In addition to that, you've had flooding along the Mississippi River, and Alabama is still recovering from its huge tornado.
Mm-hmm.
We've had listeners that we've heard from in some of those areas that have just shared stories that are wonderfully uplifting because they've survived, but also sort of heartbreaking because not everyone around there did,
right,
and certainly not intact. So if you have a chance, please, 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 go to organizations like the Red Cross, Doctors Without Borders. There are several relief organizations. We'll try to put some links in our show notes for people. Just please give as best you can. You know, $5 may not seem like much, but it'll go a long way if enough people are given $5. So now's a good time for people to pull together. This is a show about American folk magic. So these are a lot of tragedies happening in our own backyard. And
yeah,
I'd love to see us do something about it. But, so yeah, please, please, if you get a chance, give.
If you can.
Yes. All right, so do you want to share some of our perkier news?
I feel kind of sad about it now. I'm really excited because I'm going to Salem.
Yay! When are you going to Salem?
For the Pagan Podkin Supermoot.
Yay!
Two.
Part two, the sequel.
Yeah.
Yes, that will be the weekend of September, I believe, 17th, 18th, 19th.
Yes.
And I believe the 18th is the day that we're actually doing all of our meet and greets. It's the Saturday. The Saturday is when we're doing our meet and greets.
Yes.
It may be the 17th, but whatever it is, it's
definitely
Saturday.
No, Sunday is the 18th.
Okay, so it's the 17th is when all the meet and greets are.
Yes.
So anyway, so the weekend, which includes September 17th, we will be in Salem for a big Pagan Podkin Supermoot. This is going to have at least 13 people at last count. I think we're moving more towards like 14 or 15. You'll get to meet Firelight, Velma Nightshade, Chris Rapella may be coming, Saturn from Pennies in the Well is definitely coming, Orion Sphinx is definitely coming.
She's definitely coming? I thought she was...
I think she's like a 99% sure, like barring a meteor hitting her.
Yeah.
In the head, she's going to be there. So we've got so many
Peter
people.
Peter Padden
is going to be there, which I'm really like. I don't want to say I'm like shocked that he's going to be there, but like, you know, he's out in California, and I didn't think he would want to come that far. But then again, Saturn's from Canada, and
right,
the other side of Canada. So
yes, I'm just super excited because I didn't get to go to the first one, and I really wanted to go to this one. So if you're anywhere close and you have the means, please come meet us. We would love to meet listeners.
Yes, that's a really big thing. Is like, we're totally going to geek out over each other. Jillian's going to be there. She's awesome. We're totally going to be geeking out over each other. But beyond that, like, some of the best stuff was like meeting the fans last year that came out to see us. They were just, it was really, really fun. And like we have really, really like good fans who like know stuff. Like they enjoy listening to us, and they talk to us about what they've been hearing, and they give us really good feedback in person. It's just so much fun.
Yeah.
And I feel really bad because one of our super fans missed us by like 5 minutes last year.
Oh yeah, I remember
which
that.
Which just breaks my heart.
That was sad.
But she's awesome, and she's been stellar. Like I consider her a friend at this point, not just a fan.
But one thing I did want to talk about is this sounds so like silly kind of, but no flash photography, please. But seriously, like, I don't want my picture taken.
Yes.
So, like, Corey and I are trying to think of something funny to do to kind of, like, make a joke about it. But I really just can't chance, you know, being in the closet, basically. I can't chance something.
Leaking to the internet where,
right, where
her family can see it.
Something could happen. And I know it's, like, the internet's a big place, but it just, I don't want to take that chance. So I would really appreciate it if you would, you know, understand where I'm coming from, which I know most, if not all of you do.
Yeah, our fans will understand that. Yeah. You know, if you come out and we meet you, we will give you hugs, and if you want autographs, I don't know why you would, we'll give you hugs and write our names on paper for you, as long as those pieces of paper are not contracts obligating us to things unearthly and unnatural. You know, any, you know, love to spend time with you, have conversations with you.
Yeah, there's even probably going to be like a listener invited lunch that day, correct?
Yeah, I think so.
So, yeah, come have lunch with us. I would love that. But, just no pictures of me, please.
Yes. You can take all the pictures of me you want.
Yeah.
If you want, I can even put a wig on and pretend to be Lane. We've discussed many options, some of which are far weirder than that.
Yeah. Like, I'll be bringing a sock puppet and standing behind Corey and holding the sock up behind his shoulder.
I'm reasonably sure that's the best route.
I agree. Because you're tall enough that I can hide behind you.
Yes, and we will have Lane the sock puppet in our photos.
Oh my god, that'd be hilarious.
So, at any rate, please do come out, because it's going to be so much fun. And Salem, I mean, I've only been to Salem once, and it was for less than a day, but it was awesome.
See, I've never been, and I'm super excited about going.
Yeah, it's really cool. Like, it's hokey in some places because you get, like, the animatronic witchcraft museum exhibits where it's like you're watching a witch trial being reenacted by, like, Robo-Goody.
Oh my god, that's terrifying. Robo-Goody.
Goody hexadecimal, you know? And that's not all that much fun.
Oh, god.
But otherwise, like, it's just a party, and also delicious food up there. It's really good. I like seafood, though. I know you're not a fan of seafood.
I am not.
But that's okay. They will be delicious things. So much delicious stuff. And beer.
And beer.
And beer. That's awesome. I'm so looking forward to
that. Me too. I can't wait.
So that's the other big announcement. I will have graduate school coming up here in about 3 weeks. I leave for the summer again.
That quick?
3 weeks.
Lord have mercy.
So we may get one more episode out before I leave for graduate school, and then there's a pretty good chance we'll have a 6 week sort of lull, in which we'll put out maybe one episode.
Yeah.
Which really won't be that far off from our normal schedule at this point.
Yeah.
And you've used Skype before as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we might be able to Skype an episode together if we have to.
Right.
So we'll.
Yes, I'm so excited. I keep thinking about Salem. Okay, sorry. I'm not excited about you leaving, though.
Oh.
I'll be sad.
You think you're going to be sad? My poor wife.
Yeah, that's very true. She's, with two kids now.
I know.
Both times you've left, she's had a baby, like, that just came.
That's true. I'm a terrible person. No, I do my best to make up for it for the rest of the year.
Yeah, you do.
But anyway, if for some reason there is a bit of a lull there,
that's
what's going on.
Right.
It's not that we're going away. I think everybody who's listening to us now knows that we're not going away. You can't get rid of us. I'm like a bad penny. We always turn up. all right. So this episode's gone on long enough. We hope you've enjoyed our discussion of magical professions and all of our fun, exciting news. If you have any questions, you can direct them to our email at compassandkey@gmail.com.
Or you can see our show notes or leave us a comment on the blog, and that's newworldwitchery.com.
And until next time, we wish you all the best, and thanks for listening.
Be well.
New World Witchery is recorded using GarageBand on Mac. The song you're listening to is Homebound by the artist Jag from Cypress Grove Blues. It can be found on magnatune.com.
Magnatune, your source for PodSafe music.